judgment now in the case of Escamilla against Yulia.
May it please the court, Mr. Nicholas Escamilla claims that he is actually innocent and was wrongly convicted in violation of his constitutional rights and has asked for habeas corpus relief. On the morning of February 10th, after he'd worked all night, he was arrested and taken to the police. Mr. Escamilla claims that the police beat him, kicked him, slapped him, threatened to arrest his pregnant wife, who was having a difficult pregnancy, threatened to put his young daughter into foster care, and promised that if he'd only confess, they wouldn't charge him with a crime. And so after being up for a day and a half, he confessed. When they got to trial, Mr. Escamilla told his lawyer, "I didn't do it. This confession was beaten out of me. They tricked me. They forced me." And his lawyer told him, "No one's going to believe you. You'd better get on the stand. You'd better testify consistent with this confession, or I'm out of here. You don't have a lawyer." So he did what he was told, and he was convicted. At the trial, Mr. Escamilla's lawyer initially filed a motion to suppress the confession and then withdrew the motion before talking to Mr. Escamilla about it. He tricked Mr. Escamilla into signing the agreement. Mr. Escamilla didn't realize the motion had already been withdrawn. At the trial, the only evidence that tied Mr. Escamilla to the crime, there wasn't a single eyewitness, there wasn't a single piece of evidence, the only evidence that tied him to the crime was this confession.
And there was no pretrial litigation?
At all? Apparently not. No, it was withdrawn by trial panel. In 1997, the Illinois Supreme Court denied Mr. Escamilla's petition for leave to appeal. He did not file a writ of certiorari. That, of course, is the basis for the timeliness claim. In May of 2000, Mr. Escamilla filed his pro se petition for a writ of habeas corpus. It was dismissed to permit exhaustion of state remedies. He did that. Ultimately, he filed his amended habeas petition on February 17, 2004. According to Mr. Escamilla, during the time that he was incarcerated, he and his family continued to investigate and ultimately found that the police officers, one in particular, that had been involved in his beating and the coercion of his confession, had actually been involved in similar situations with other people. And in fact, and probably most importantly, in 2002, Rafael Ramirez, who was one of the prosecutor's witnesses at the trial and had testified, not that he'd seen Mr. Escamilla, but rather that there had been three people in the car. And the third person would have been Escamilla, according to the coerced confession. But Mr. Rafael Robinson, in 2002, recanted his testimony and said that he, in fact, had been coerced by the police and had been told by the police, "You've got to implicate these guys." Even so, there still was no evidence against Mr. Escamilla. But in 2002 now, we have this eyewitness recanting his story. By then, Mr. Escamilla had filed his petition for habeas relief. I've been told, and I can't verify it, but I've been told that actually the man who was convicted of shooting has been granted a habeas petition based on Mr. Robinson's recantation. Mr. Escamilla isn't looking to be released right now. What he's looking for is a hearing where he has a chance to prove his innocence. And this petition is based on essentially two arguments. One, newly discovered evidence, which would erase any time problems. And secondly, a miscarriage of justice along with actual innocence.
The problem is that newly discovered evidence doesn't restart the clock under the statute. What language in the statute are you relying on?
That would be section
2244D1D, which sounds like the closest one, restarts the clock on, and I quote, "the date on which the factual predicate of the claim of claims presented could have been discovered." but the factual predicate here is the claim that the confession was coerced. And that was discovered, if your client is telling the truth, even before the trial. Right? The statute says the claim. It doesn't say evidence in support of the claim.
From Mr. Escamilla's position, he told his lawyer, the person who was retained to represent him, that he had been coerced. And his lawyer said, no one will believe you. And so until he had knowledge of a pattern of abuse, he didn't have the factual predicate to allow him to proceed.
Certainly he did. He had his own evidence. Now, he may have thought that that wasn't sufficient, rightly or wrongly. But it wouldn't be very much of a statute of limitations if one could say the clock doesn't start if the plaintiff thinks he's going to lose. The clock begins to run when the plaintiff finally thinks he can win. And that would just destroy the statute. We might as well blot it off the statute books.
If, in fact, it was only the knowledge of his own beating, the knowledge that he had told his own lawyer, then there is a timeliness problem. However, we also have the fact that Mr. Robinson, the witness who said there was a third man there, the other two had been identified, that left Mr. Escamilla. Mr. Robinson, in 2002, recanted his statement saying that the police had coerced him. Certainly, Mr. Escamilla filed...
Right, but that's back to the question. Is that a claim, or is that just more evidence in support of a claim?
In this particular...
The statute says the date on which the factual predicate of the claim or claims presented could have been discovered. What would be your best authority for the proposition that the claim means evidence in support of the claim?
I don't have anything that says evidence in support of the claim.
Well, in fact, this court has held the opposite on a number of occasions, such as Owens.
Right.
So you can't win at a minimum unless we overrule Owens. I just wondered whether maybe there was some case in some other circuit that might support you.
I think you can say that the claim is based on Mr. Raphael Robinson's recantation. And in fact, at that point, he does learn that there was coerced testimony used to convict him. And at that point, he does have a claim, and based on that, his claim was timely. The other argument that we have is based on miscarriage of justice. And for miscarriage of justice, the court can address the merits of a procedurally defaulted.
What statute are you relying on to say that some general claim of miscarriage of justice restarts the clock? That doesn't look like anything that restarts the clock at all.
It's actual innocence, Your Honor.
Where in the statute is there a statement that a claim of actual innocence restarts the clock?
Your Honor, that is not specifically in the
statute. It's not in the statute. Actual innocence is in the statute as something that would excuse a procedural default. But there are separate requirements. You've got to present the claim to state court. Actual innocence will excuse that, and you've got to litigate on time. And there's nothing in the statute that I can see that says that if you're claiming actual innocence, we just throw the statute of limitations away. Certainly isn't. There's nothing in the statute that says that.
Your Honor, if a man is actually innocent and in prison, we see cases all the time where people come in with DNA evidence. In this case, even though it may be procedurally defaulted, it fits within the miscarriage of justice exception if there's a...
There is no miscarriage of justice exception to the statute of limitations. It's just not there. I think you agree with that. Right, there's a list of four things that restart the clock, and general miscarriage of justice is not one of them. What does one do? We either follow the statute or just make things up? The Supreme Court has said in Dodd last spring that the statute of limitations could well expire before the claim had arisen. And that was just the way the AEDPA worked. That was sometimes essential if we're ever going to have finality in criminal judgments. And given Dodd, how can one make this kind of claim?
I don't practice in criminal law. That's not my general area. But I have to admit that as I started looking through the habeas statutes and the rules and the regulations, they're incredibly complicated. And
actually, 2244B2 is pretty clear. It's just a simple list of four things. Tax law is complicated. This is simple.
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, you see a lot more of this than I do. But as looking at it, it's complicated. And Mr. Escamilla was doing what he thought was supposed to be done at the time he was supposed to have done it. Now, yes, he does have some timeliness problems. I will concede that. However, we have a situation where we may very well have an innocent man in prison who was there because of a coerced confession, the coerced testimony of another,
and his own testimony.
His own testimony based on that coerced
confession. Which he now accuses himself of the crime of perjury.
He was told by his lawyer he had to testify based on his confession.
It's no defense to a charge of perjury.
I wasn't claiming that it was, simply that was his understanding, and that's what he did. But we have an ineffective assistance of counsel issue, some Fifth and Sixth Amendment violations. Under Strickland, certainly there was deficiency where the counsel withdrew the argument trying to quash the confession. There was prejudice because that was the only argument against him. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Mr. Hoffman. Well, Ms. Hansen, since I consumed some of your time, I'll give you a minute for rebuttal so you can plan on that.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Attorney General Jay Hoffman here on behalf of the respondent today. As was brought up during counsel's argument, the question before this court today is basically whether or not the district court properly determined that the habeas petition in this case was untimely. There was no argument that it is timely under the general section, that's D1A, being 1 year from the time of the conclusion of direct appeal. Indeed, it was filed approximately 2.5 years after the conclusion of direct appeal. Instead, respondent has argued that under D1D, the opinion, rather the denial of petition for leave to appeal by the Illinois Supreme Court on direct appeal is a factual predicate. Second of all, he claims that alleged actual innocence should excuse his untimeliness. Third of all, he says that there should be a matter of equitable tolling being applied because his materials, which he gave to someone in prison to help him file his habeas petition, were taken with that person when he was transferred. None of these have any merit. First of all, if Owens v. Boyd, this court's decision in Owens v. Boyd, does not preclude the argument that D1D means that the state court's opinion is a factual predicate. This court's recent opinion in Daniels v. Uchtman settled that question beyond all doubt. Besides Owens v. Boyd, in our brief, we had cited cases from the 5th District, Yabanis v. Johnson, Red v. McGrath from the 9th, and Berger v. Scott from the 10th, all of which agree with that. And the United States Supreme Court's opinion in Johnson, of course, is distinguishable because there we're dealing about a factual situation where the state court opinion actually created the fact, that is, did away with a previous conviction. Second of all, with regard to the actual innocence, this court in Gilden v. Bowen, as the court has noted before, first, the actual innocence exception is not in the statute, and this court...
It is in the statute. It just serves a function other than restarting the clock. It excuses procedural default, and that may be absolutely vital. It's in the statute. We just have to figure out how it's in the statute.
I was incomplete. It's not in the statute with regard to timeliness. This court has said in Gilden v. Bowen, while refusing to decide whether or not actual innocence could ever excuse untimeliness, said that, at the very least, the defendant must show some action or inaction by respondent that prevented him from discovering relevant facts in a timely manner or at the very least that a reasonably diligent person could not have discovered the facts in time to file the timely petition. Here, there's no doubt that petitioner could have discovered those facts. First of all, the facts with regard to his allegations that he was beaten, which is his primary claim. He knew that fact. That fact was made before trial, before the motion was withdrawn. And in addition, if you look at the factors which he claims in his new evidence, those factors were known or could have been known through due diligence long before, 1 year before he filed his claim. He cites to a 1993 Tribune article before he was even tried, which talks about beatings by Chicago police officers.
Actually, back in 1996, you may not be aware of this, we heard en banc a civil damages action arising out of a claim of coercion by the very same police officers. This was before he was convicted. And that what was going on at that station was not exactly secret.
Exactly, Your Honor, which is our point. Not only was his claim, did he know of his claim, but the factors supporting his claim were all there. In addition to that Tribune article, an officer of police responsibility report was made public in May of 1997. He admits that. Indeed, his counsel, before withdrawing the motion, got a internal police report regarding allegations against these same officers and decided later, after that, not to file this claim, not to file, to withdraw the motion. So with that and the other things I listed in the brief, certainly there was a plethora of evidence there before he was tried and before he filed his post-conviction petition, before he filed his, more than a year before he filed his initial habeas petition.
As an aside, counsel, I take it that Illinois doesn't have a rule of criminal procedure that requires a hearing before a confession is admitted?
I'm sorry, that requires
That requires a hearing before a confession, an admissibility hearing before a confession is admitted. You don't have that kind of procedural rule? Okay.
Finally, the last claim to excuse untimeliness is this tolling issue, and I was set forth in the brief. Recently, this court in Williams v. Sims determined that in certain circumstances tolling is applicable, but it again made it clear that it's a very extraordinary circumstance, cited to Nadrowski v. Moat and several earlier decisions, noting that even a reasonable misunderstanding of the law does not lead to equitable tolling. In Nadrowski v. Moat, of course, a counseled petitioner failed by 1 day to meet the habeas statute, and this court said no, it was properly dismissed as untimely. Therefore, certainly when petitioner relies upon the aid or the wrongful aid of an inmate, this court should not find equitable tolling. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, we ask this court to affirm the finding of the district court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything further?
I will confine my comments to discussing the Daniels case, which counsel just referred to as supporting their position. I think the Daniels case actually supports Mr. Escamilla's argument. In the Daniels case, several years after being convicted, a witness recanted his testimony. Habeas petition was filed under 2244 D1D, and the court held that the execution of that affidavit recanting the testimony was in fact the factual predicate for Mr. Daniels' claims. However, Mr. Daniels still missed the one-year deadline for filing his petition for habeas corpus. In this case, if we look at Mr. Robinson's declaration in 2002 as the factual predicate under 2244 D1D, Mr. Escamilla did timely file his petition for habeas corpus relief because that was filed back in May of 2000. So I think the Daniels case, rather than supporting the respondent, in fact supports the petitioner. Nothing else?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And Ms. Hanson, we want to particularly thank you not only for accepting the appointment of the court, both you and your firm for accepting the appointment of the court and the assistance you've been, but also for stepping in rather late in the case at a time when Most appellate lawyers might think that it was a little late to reshape the arguments. So we express particular gratitude to you and your firm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.